The red sun of the dying workday washed the promenade with the color of old blood. People still crowded the walkway, going to the elevators to begin late shifts, coming through the entrance gate and heading to their homes. Morales had been waiting for nearly half an hour. Following Salvo's order, he wore a dark green, untailored bodysuit and was fiddling with the lamps in the evergreen trees, trying to look as if he knew what he was doing. Then, finally, he saw the woman. There was no denying Bridget Baptiste's striking appearance, and it went well with her brisk, almost manly stride. Her blue bodysuit conformed to every curve of her tall, willowy body. Even with her hair pinned up in a constraining bun and the quaint eyeglasses perched on the bridge of her nose, Morales could understand why Kane had made a midnight visit to her apartment. Evidently Salvo did not. Morales waited until she passed through the gate on her way to the elevator before he climbed out from the tree line and walked casually along the promenade toward the apartment blocks. Bridget Baptiste's apartment was as simple and utilitarian as his own, except his was substantially smaller. He lived three levels below, so the size difference was understandable, but it was still irritating. The curtains were drawn across the three back windows, so only a dim light filled the place. He groped his way to the bedroom, found the bedside lamp, and switched it on. There was nothing out of the ordinary to see, much less the anything Salvo had commanded him to find. The room smelled of aromatic soap with a faint whiff of roses. Morales made a quick circuit of the apartment, looking in drawers, picking into food canisters, even inspecting the contents of the small refrigerator in the kitchenette. The place was very clean, almost compulsively tidy. That certainly wasn't out of the ordinary, since archivists possessed rigidly regimented personalities. Careful not to leave anything out of place, he returned to the bedroom. On the bedside table was a framed photo, which at first he assumed was a pic of Baptiste herself. Then he realized the woman in the photograph was a bit older, but the resemblance was startling. She was beaming at the camera with a wide, pearly smile. Morales wondered if Baptiste looked that heart-achingly beautiful when, or if, she smiled. He slid open the closet door and gave the clothes hanging there a cursory, disinterested inspection. As he was sliding the door shut, a faint gleam caught his eye. He parted a pair of hanging bodysuits, realizing the closet was deeper than standard, and then saw the little desktop work area the woman had made for herself. The comp console was an obsolete DDC manual model. He looked at it, turned away, then looked at it again and thought it over. It was fairly common, if unspoken, knowledge that some archivists were allowed a wide latitude in the performance of their duties. Owning a cast-off comp wasn't a capital crime. It was against the rules, but anyone who ranked high in any of the divisions bent the rules to some degree or another. Reporting the comp to Salvo might result in a reprimand for Bridget Baptiste, or at worst, a lowering of her seniority. That action might leave her apartment vacant. He brightened at the possibility, though he knew Salvo would hardly be satisfied with a comp possession charge. He'd need more to obtain a reward. Sitting down in the chair in front of the machine, Morales turned it on, waited until it had warmed up, and the monitor flashed the request for the password. He tried several, hoping the DDC wasn't equipped with an automatic lockout after a certain number of failed attempts. After the third try, he paused, reviewing the little he knew of the woman, of the sparse clues to character he might have seen in his search of her apartment. A notion registered, and he pecked out, "Mom."
Yes.
The screen flashed and displayed the files. There was only one available on the desktop, so he tapped the keys to open it. Text appeared on the monitor, and he began to read.
Possible origin of Magistrate Division, source DOD document dated 4/30/94. The concept of a one-world government was known in pre-dark vernacular as the New World Order. The globalist view was opposed by many American citizens as a conspiracy to remove legal and civil rights granted to them by the Constitution. Refile number 01405. Well, bitch, you just bought yourself a one-way ticket to Shit City. You're a fucking preservationist!
Bridget Baptiste stepped through the archway and into the historical division. She passed other archivists going off shift, and most of their facial expressions mirrored her own, somber and serenely detached, with perhaps a touch of cold intellectual resolve. The primary difference between her and the other historians was the awareness that her center of interest had changed completely in the past 16 hours. Bridget Baptiste was increasingly thinking of a place called Dulce and a man named Kane. The man had presented her with a mystery to solve, but she wasn't sure if that prospect stimulated her as much as Kane himself. She had seen plenty of mags stalking the promenade in search of laws to enforce, and they had always reminded her of tigers on loose leashes. But Kane displayed a wry humor and even exuded an almost reluctant kindness, touched as it was with reserve and introspection. She hadn't expected that. Of course, she hadn't expected him to be shit-faced either. Though she was anxious to begin work, Bridget maintained a steady pace. She walked through the long, broad corridors of the division, past scores of sealed doorways that led into hundreds of chambers and antechambers. All of them were filled with the relics of vanished cities and long-dead people. Many of the rooms were strictly off-limits to anyone not holding a queue clearance. When she had been granted her Quattro designation, Lockish himself had taken her on a guided tour of a few of the storerooms. Most were crammed to the ceiling with shelves upon shelves of a vast number of books and bound volumes of magazines and technical manuals that had been printed on non-biodegradable stock. There were trunks of clothing, crates of paintings, pieces of statuary and sculpture. In short, anything and everything that had survived the new cost, more or less intact. Lakesh had told her, voice full of pride, that the Koboldville archives contained a greater volume of pre-dark artifacts than any other vill in the network. Bridget entered her work area, the chemically treated rainbow insignia on her bodysuit allowing her to pass through the invisible photoelectric field without activating alarms. There was a long row of computer stations, half enclosed by partitions, all facing a long, blank wall. Hidden behind the stone and steel-reinforced wall was a bank of sophisticated mainframe computers, the heart and brains of the division's database. Lakesh was waiting, standing by her workstation, holding her day's work in one liver-spotted hand.
How are you today, Bridget?
Fine, sir.
Bridget reached for the bulging file folder in his hand. Lakesh was a long-nosed, wizened cadaver of a man. He wore thick-lensed glasses with a hearing aid attached to the right earpiece. No one knew his actual age, but he was old. He was the oldest man Bridget had ever seen. He also made her extremely nervous on some days. He purposely made their hands touch when she took the file from him. His skin was cold, clammy, almost as if ice water flowed through him. Bridget sat down before her console. Lakesh lingered, as he usually did, behind her chair.
Nothing too complicated today. Editing down and consolidating a series of reports on the causes of the Bosnian War.
Simple, is it?
Lakesh was utterly, absolutely, and thoroughly devoted to his art. History was his obsession, his reason for breathing, and he lived only to record it for posterity. His roomy blue eyes widened, and she knew she had inadvertently pressed his lecture mode button.
Simple. Did the Bosnians, the Serbs, the Croats, the Muslims, indeed, the citizens of the entire pre-dark world, have the future they wanted? Hardly. The causes of war are never simply based on territorial struggle, economic conflict, or religious or ethnic differences. If we don't come to terms with that, the cycle repeats itself, doesn't it? The whole of history, all over again.
Bridget had heard variations of Lakesh's pet theories about time cycles, about one event impacting on another, continents even centuries apart. Sometimes it was a bit too metaphysical for Bridget to comprehend.
The future, if we still have one, could have been changed in the past, you know. Oh, dear, I'm ranting again, aren't I? And you're too well-bred to ignore or interrupt me. Well, I must be onward, ever onward. Get to it, Bridget.
Bridget gazed after his parting, age-stooped form for a moment. For a vill official in any division, Lakesh was a definite anomaly. The most productive years of his service were long behind him, and why he hadn't received an administrative transfer decades ago was baffling. Bridget flipped open the cover of the file and began working. She expected the documents to be dry packing, and she wasn't disappointed. But as she always did, she kept her expression and mind neutral as she read the copies of the 200-year-old reports. There were pages upon pages of it, culled from various and sundry pre-dark governmental bodies, CIA, NSA, UNSC, DIA, and something called Amnesty International. Though several pages were already censored, blacked out with ink, she was able to patch together a fairly reasonable account of the causes behind the horrific genocidal conflict in old Europe. People were at the heart of it, of course. Disobedient, unevolved, unregenerately selfish humans who surrendered to their baser natures and slaughtered and massacred and tortured on very flimsy pretexts. Despite what Lakish had said, reading through and collating all the data to conform with the standard point of view was simplicity itself. Finally, with only 3 hours remaining in her shift, Bridget indulged in a stretch. She allowed a bit of the professional distance to fade from her mind. The recollection of Kane's visit immediately came to mind. She shook her head impatiently. There had been other men in her life, a few fellow historians, but none she had ever truly connected with. She was vil-bred, just like the men she had involved herself with, so she never quite grasped why the emotional spark couldn't bridge the gap. They had been raised much like herself, ordered, fed, clothed, educated, and protected from all extremes. And their narrow, limited perspectives, their solemn pronouncements regarding their ambitions, had bored her into a coma. Of course, she couldn't be certain, but she doubted Kane would have the same effect. Without appearing to do so, Bridget made sure none of her co-workers were paying attention to her. Then she selected a blank disk and inserted it into her machine's hard drive. She typed in the proper numerical sequence to access the main database, then input the word Dulce. As she had anticipated, the programmed safeguard kicked in, and the legend on the screen asked for her access authorization. She tapped in Baptiste, Grade 6, Archives, Clearance 4. The data infeed digested the identification and transmitted the message to her console. Authorization denied. Bridget tensed. If she tried again and was denied again, she would trip a security relay and alert a monitoring official. She thought about it dispassionately for half a minute before she cleared the screen and typed in Lakish, Grade 12, Archives, Clearance Zeno. The words authorization granted flashed on the screen, disappeared, and an instant later were replaced by a red triangle bisected by three black vertical lines. Glowing beneath the symbol was a list of available historical files dealing with Dulce, arranged by date. She chose the one dated 12/20/2000, highlighted it, and opened it up. Her face remained a detached mask, but her heartbeat sped up, and she had a difficult time discreetly swallowing the lump forming in her throat. The report had been prepared for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Defense Advanced Research Programs Agency, all pre-dark institutions with a monomania about secrecy, and presumably the incoming commander-in-chief, since it was dated only 30 days before the presidential inauguration ceremony, and the nuke cost. Bridget scrolled down to an index. 1. Totality concept progression. 2. Redoubt construction. 3. Archon directive perspective. 4. Appendix. She read each entry carefully, mentally cross-indexing them with information already secure within her memory. The third entry intrigued her on an emotional level, though intellectually she provided herself with a thumbnail explanation. She knew that Archon was an ancient Greek term for the magistrates in many city-states. Presumably the Archon Directive perspective related to the international police force that was being assembled prior to the nuke cost. Of course, another and far older definition of Archon came from an ancient understanding of the world in which the Archons were forces lined up on the side of dark against the glory of light. She recalled that the recurring mythological image of Archons was that of jailers, imprisoning the divine spark in human souls. However, due to her recollections of the references to it in the Wyeth Codex, she decided to heed her intellect and act in a thorough manner. She highlighted the first index entry and opened it. An organizational chart appeared on the screen. Totality Concept. Over Project Whisper. Project Cerberus Operation Kronos. Over Project Excalibur. Genesis Project Invictus, Scenario Joshua. Over Project Majestic. Mission Snowbird, Re-Archon Directive, Project Sigma. Appendix, PTBE. She recognized Over Project Whisper, Project Cerberus, and Operation Kronos from the Wyeth Codex, so she moved the comp's cursor to Project Cerberus and touched a key. Quantum Interphase Matrans Inducer Operations. 1. Subject Scan, Coordinate Lock. 2. Auto Scanner Initiation. 3. Interphase Matter Stream Transmission Cycle. 4. Subject Transmission. 5. Subject Reception, Rematerialization. Operational Timeline, 6.2 seconds. A diagram appeared, a jumble of geometric cones and ellipses and hexagons. Though she had to stare hard at it, Bridget realized she was looking at a schematic of a gateway Mattrans unit. It was a six-sided chamber, and the cutaway view depicted machinery beneath the platform of the unit. All the pieces of hardware were labeled, with arrow-tipped lines pointing to them. Emitter array, interphase transition coils, virtual focus conformals. Bridget scrolled down to a column of digits identified as destination lock codes. Opposite them was a list of redoubt names and locations, 3 in New Mexico, she noted right away, and number 4 in Montana. A brief postscript indicated that construction and gateway installation on redoubts Tango, Victor, Yankee, Zulu, November, Oscar, and Golf were expected to be completed by the first of the new year. The data permanently impressed itself on the photosensitive plate of her memory. As it did so, a riot of conflicting emotions exploded in her mind. First and foremost was the wild ecstasy of discovery. Then her 27 years of conditioning kicked in and brought a bone-chilling terror that dried the saliva in her mouth. Her eyes were seeing things never meant to be seen. Her mind did an insane pirouette, and she recalled the ancient myths of the Gorgons and of Lot's wife in the Bible. She waited to be turned either to stone or to a pillar of salt. After a few seconds, neither occurred, and her mind stopped twirling. Bridget returned to the index and shifted the cursor from the bottom up, highlighting the appendix. A page of text appeared. Paraterrestrial Biological Entity, Re 3, Archon Directive Perspective. The typical PTBE, as represented by participants in the Archon Directive at the Dulce installation, can be described as follows. 1. Between 3 to 5 feet in height. 2. Erect standing biped, short thin legs. 3. Gracile skeletal structure. 4. Cranium larger than normal human proportions. 5. Absence of auditory lobes, external ear apparatus. 6. Absence of body hair. 7. Large, tear-shaped eyes, generally opaque black with vertical slit pupils. 8. Eyes slanted approximately 35 degrees. 9. Small, straight mouth, thin lips. 10. Disproportionately long arms. 11. Tough gray epidermis. 12. Internal organs similar to humans, but developed and arranged differently. 13. Blood type is Rh, re Basque people. 14. Significant secondary findings after permitted study indicates the PTBEs require human blood plasma and other human biological substances to survive. In extreme circumstances, they can subsist on other animal fluids, such as cattle or other domesticated animals. Bridget felt as if her entire mind were immersed in soggy cotton wadding. Intellectually, she could conceive of extraterrestrial life forms, but emotionally, she felt a visceral, xenophobic cringing. She wanted to blank out the screen, to convince herself that what she read was part of an elaborate pre-dark hoax, but the text itself was imprinted indelibly within her eidetic memory. For as long as she lived, no matter how hard she tried, she would never forget it. She wondered what Cain and she had stumbled into. She pushed the keys to begin the copying sequence, her hands moving with a numb slowness that shocked her.
Baptiste? Yes, yes indeed. There she is.
Bridget turned her head in the direction of the voice. In the archway stood Lakesh. For a long heartbeat, she couldn't understand why he looked so sad, so desperately old, so crushed by the weight of his years. Then her eyes swept over the 3 black-coated men with him, and her near-paralyzed thought processes identified them. They were magistrates, and Lakesh was pointing her out to them. She quickly broke the data link, or tried to do so. The incriminating text still glowed on the screen, white against amber. The copying process continued without interruption. Terror was pushed aside by the sickening realization that she had been found out and that Kane had used her for the sole purpose of betraying her. The taste of the realization was so bitter she nearly gagged. She had been manipulated into breaking the cardinal rule of life in the Vills: trust no one. A man suddenly loomed over her, a flat-faced, thin-lipped man with short, thin hair. Bridget looked up at him. His eyes, masked by dark glasses, were unfathomable, but she saw her own face dimly reflected in the lenses. She smiled at her face, a small smile of resignation and defiance. The man tilted his head slightly, toward the screen and the information glowing there. He smiled, too. Then, with a clenched, gloved fist, he struck her in the face. Two mags from Intel were sitting in the bare-walled room, saying nothing and trying to keep awake. Kane occupied a chair at a table across from them, waiting for Salvo to arrive to take his statement. He tried to believe that a statement would make a difference. His head wound, treated at the scene by a medic, felt like a wag tire with multiple ruptures. A thin, flesh-colored film covered the bullet graze, adhering tightly to his forehead. The liquid bandage contained nutrients and antibiotics, and since its chemical composition was very similar to real epidermal tissue, his body would absorb it as the injury healed. Boone would never heal. He was the first mag in decades to be chilled while on a pit patrol, and Kane hadn't chilled all the chillers or even called for backup. It was hours past his off-shift time. Upon returning to the division, Grant and Kane were immediately separated. Since then, he had been sitting, waiting, and wondering how long it would take Salvo to arrive, and how bad things would become. On the table lay Doss's mini-Uzi, retrieved from the wreckage of the squat. That and the strong-arm's body were the only pieces of evidence incriminating Guana Teague as the mastermind. But Kane didn't accept the concept of Teague as the master of anything, even his own soul. Pollard lumbered into the room. He smiled blandly.
Kane.
Pollard. Where's Salvo?
On an op. I'm the watch commander, so you'll have to talk to me.
And Grant?
Got his story already. Let's hear yours and mix and match him.
Kane told him what had occurred during the PPP, not leaving out or embellishing a single detail.
Marvelous. There are holes in your story big enough to drive a goddamn sandcat through. You're about a millimeter from finding your ass in front of a tribunal.
Where are the holes? You talked to Grant already, so he told you the same thing.
According to him, you believed it was a contract chill and Boone got in the way.
That's how I read it. Why else would Uno ice Dos?
You tell me.
To keep him from fingering Guana.
Maybe yes, maybe no. Grant has some serious problems with your theory.
Come on. Don't play that moldy old game with me, Polly.
Don't call me Polly, you arrogant bastard!
Kane came up out of his chair so fast that it fell over backward. Watching the action, unmoved and unmoving, the other two mags were as quiet as a pair of statues. Kane clenched his fists so hard that his knuckles began to ache.
You want to make this personal, you overstuffed dipshit. We're both healed, right?
Pollard raised his right hand, slightly curling the fingers. His eyes impaled Kane with twin shafts of anger.
We've worked together for years. If you're such a stoop you don't remember, I have no patience for games. I'll jog your memory. Here and now, make your move.
Sit down, Kane. Forget it. I didn't mean to lean on you. Boone's dead. All of us are shook up over it.
Kane didn't budge.
You talked to Grant.
Yeah, his story was substantially the same as yours.
Then why are we sitting here stepping on each other's dicks? Let's assemble a sweep squad and step on Guana's.
Like I said, Salvo ain't here. Only he can authorize a pit sweep. And don't even think of going back down there on your own initiative. Your unilateral decision not to call for backup buried both you and Grant neck deep in shit. You go down to the pits again, you better just stay there.
Where's Grant now?
Home, probably. I suggest you go to your own and wait for Salvo's call. I already told Grant this, so I'm telling you now. You're under orders not to contact each other until a final determination about this incident is reached.
We're suspended?
No, but you're being assigned to work different shifts until further notice.
Whatever you say.
Kane turned toward the door.
Hey.
Kane turned back. Pollard nudged the Mini-Uzi across the table toward him with a contemptuous flick of his fingers.
Drop this off in the evidence room on your way out.
Kane didn't move.
Please?
Kane picked up the blaster and strode to the door. He debated with himself on whether to slam the door behind him or simply ease it shut. He stalked down the main corridor in such an obvious anger that no one he passed dared speak to him. The evidence room was adjacent to the armory. It was located there for a number of reasons, primarily so if any weapons of value came into Mag hands, they could be simply transferred over to the Vill arsenal. Kane tapped in his badge number on the keypad affixed to the wall beside the door. Lock solenoids snapped aside. The windowless room was always dimly lit, a perpetual twilight. Behind a wire screen enclosure was the storage facility, mainly a double row of tall metal shelves. The air was hot, stale, and motionless. Russo, the attendant, looked up from filling out an invoice and squinted toward him. He was perched on a stool behind the screen, and he exuded a stale, sweaty odor from his sparse blonde hair and his wrinkled gray bodysuit. Kane could smell him, and it wasn't pleasant. Neither was Russo's attitude.
What you got there?
A blaster, lifted from the pits.
An Uzi, huh?
Close. A Mini-Uzi.
Kind of rare. Had a matched set in here a while back. Pristine condition, museum quality.
How long a while back?
A year, maybe two. Longer than that, maybe.
What happened to them?
Transferred them to the armory. Where the hell else?
Check this one out. Does it look like one of them?
No, the ones I saw were green and had mustaches. Of course it looks like them. A Mini-Uzi is a Mini-Uzi.
Kane's icy eyes bored into Russo's.
Hell, Kane, there's got to be 50 Uzis in the armory. Maybe even half a dozen of these mini-jobs. Just put it on the table there. I'll tag it later.
The table in the corner was cluttered with recent acquisitions, most of it useless salvage, like home-forged single-shot pistols, knives, and even a crude crossbow. Kane cleared a space and laid down the blaster. Squatting on one end of the table was a computer console, a DDC. He glanced at it, glanced away, then looked again. It was an old manual model, and he had seen it a little less than 24 hours ago. He knew for certain because of the fine cracks just next to the screen, which were like a stamp of identity. He spun toward Russo, feeling cold perspiration breaking out on his forehead.
When did that comp come in?
An hour, hour and a half ago. Why?
Who brought it?
Let me see. Here we go. That guy from Intel. Yeah, you know him. Dark-complected guy.
Morales.
That's him. Why? What's up with it?
Kane didn't answer.
Hey, Kane! What's up?
Half-jogging, Kane hurried down the corridor and entered Intel. His eyes swept the room. When they didn't spy Morales, he approached the nearest tech. He was a pock-faced, sleepy-eyed man. He blinked at Kane owlishly.
Morales is supposed to be on duty. Where is he?
Salvo put him on a different detail. Something about historical.
Kane darted back into the corridor and ran full out for the elevator. A clerk was exiting, his arms laden with file folders. Kane shouldered past him and punched the button for B-level. The ascent took no longer than 15 seconds, but to Kane it felt like an eternity, stretched out like a rubber band of infinite length. He sprinted through the many archways, knowing his badge was attuned to the photoelectric field sensors. He raced past doorway after doorway, past room after room, filled with all the pride and glory and foolishness of the pre-dark dead. Kane had eyes only for the living, and for the quartet of figures coming toward him beneath the final archway. They were Salvo, Morales, Waylon, and a female figure. It was Bridget Baptiste. His shocked eyes registered that her arms were held behind her at unnatural angles, bound with the standard-issue plastic riot cuffs. Her hair was disheveled, and her glasses were missing. The only color about her white, stark face was from the crimson thread streaming from her nostrils, over her lips and across her chin. Waylon, in the lead, saw him first, and he increased the length of his stride to intercept him. He held out his left hand, palm up.
Kane, stop!
Kane didn't stop, but he slowed down just enough to slap Waylon's hand aside and deliver an elbow thrust to the interceptor's throat. Shoving the choking man out of his path, he stormed on.
Kane, I order you to halt!
Kane didn't even look at him. He had eyes only for Baptiste and her pale, blood-streaked face.
I'll shoot you if you don't stop, Kane!
The Sin Eater filled Salvo's hand. Kane slowed to a walk. He saw the fear and the anger in Salvo's face, and it required a great effort to keep from filling his own hand.
What are you doing with that woman?
What's it look like? Placing a preservationist bitch under arrest. What's it to you?
Kane's blow landed like a steam-driven piston. Morales folded over and clutched at his stomach, then was hammered face first to the floor by a side-handed smash to the back of his exposed neck.
I'll tell you what it is to me, Salvo. This archivist was following up a legal line of inquiry at my request.
Who authorized it?
I did.
Then it wasn't exactly legal, was it?
Kane's eyes met Baptiste's. Though fear still swam in those clear green depths, relief gleamed there too.
Who struck you, Baptiste?
She resisted apprehension. Only the minimum force required to subdue her was employed. Damn it, have you fused out completely? She's a preservationist. Do you understand that? A fucking preservationist.
By degrees, the flame of fury in Kane's eyes was contained. Salvo noticed, and some of the tension left his posture, but he didn't holster the Sin-Eater.
You've got some explaining to do.
Waylon was back on his feet, and he weaved toward Kane on unsteady legs, clutching his throat with his left hand. His right hand gripped his Sin-Eater.
You went too far this time.
Stand down, Waylon.
Baptiste sidekicked at Salvo, but he grabbed her right arm and twisted it up in a painful hammerlock. Kane shifted position, but stopped moving when Salvo cast a hard glance in his direction. Kane assessed the situation more coolly now, looking critically at Baptiste, Waylon, Salvo, and the pair of blasters. He decided it wasn't worth the risk. If he finished what he had started, both he and Bridget would die.
You lifted a comp disc from Wreath's slag hole, didn't you?
I did. The disc had a data lockout that defied the sign.
And that aroused your curiosity.
I acted on that pissant Morales' suggestion to consult historical.
And you blundered into an ongoing op.
What kind of op?
Remember what I mentioned to you last night?
Yes.
We've suspected this bitch was a spy for quite some time, that she was feeding crucial Vill intel to the Warlord's army.
That's a lie! I was following a Magistrate Division request!
Shut up! This isn't the time or place to discuss it further. Morales and Waylon, escort this traitor to detention now.
Wait.
Face it, Kane. You were used. You fucked up. Fortunately, it helped us to nail her. Otherwise, you wouldn't be standing here. You'd be on your way to a disciplinary tribunal.
Waylon helped Morales to his feet, and Salvo pushed Baptiste at them.
Take her. And Kane. You and me are gonna have a talk.
Baptiste was led away, looking lost and slender between the black-coated magistrates. She didn't look back, for which Kane was both grateful and sad.
I heard about the ambush, about Boone. I'm taking into consideration that's one reason you're behaving like a wired-out joltwalker.
Big-hearted of you. I want to be in on the woman's interrogation.
What makes you think there's going to be one?
Salvo made an exaggerated show of leathering his Sin-Eater.
Anyway, we'll see. After our talk.
I thought we just had it. Sir.
By no means, Kane. Follow me.
Kane fell into step, and they walked down the musty-smelling hallway. Just inside the archway stood a very old man, one of the oldest Kane had ever seen outside of the pits. His blue eyes were so watery, he looked as if he was preparing to weep.
You're in on this too, Lakesh. Alert the others.
Kane and Salvo had returned to sea level. By the time the elevator had deposited them on the division floor, Bridget Baptiste had already been escorted to detention at the far end of the operation suites. Kane followed Salvo into his office. Salvo sat down behind his desk.
Why are we here?
Where else should we be?
Down in Tartarus, putting the arm on Guanateague. He was behind the ambush. He used a little albino tramp with a bogus chip as a lure.
Drop it, Kane. Forget Guana.
He chilled a magistrate and tried to chill another. Once word spreads, not a single mag will be safe in the pit.
I said drop it! The matter will be dealt with on my terms. You've got a very full evening ahead of you.
I don't get you.
Take off your coat. Remove your sidearm.
Are you suspending me?
Do as I say, or you'll be hoping for something as soft as suspension.
Kane hesitated. Then, with deliberate slowness, shrugged out of his coat and draped it over the back of the chair. He unstrapped the Sin-Eater from his forearm and dropped it on the center of the desk. Salvo made no move to touch it.
Sit.
Defiantly spinning the chair around, Kane thrust it between his legs and straddled it so that he could see the door and Salvo at the same time.
Now what?
Now we wait.
For what? A disciplinary tribunal to convene?
Keep your mouth shut and your ears open and you'll find out.
Salvo didn't open the circuit. From the desk drawer, he produced a set of goggles. The plastic lenses were thick and a deep black in color. He stood up.
Let's go.
Where?
Where I tell you.
Kane rose, reaching for his sin-eater.
Leave it.
Kane picked up his coat.
Leave it.
Kane put the coat down and followed Salvo out the door. Kane refused to dog Salvo's heels, so he fell into step beside him as they strode down the corridor, past the evidence room and the recessed sec door of the armory. When they passed it, Kane almost slowed his pace. All that lay beyond the armory was the detention area. His lips moved in a thin half-smile. If Salvo intended to lead him there and expected him to meekly enter a cell, he would receive one of the most painful surprises of his life. Instead, they turned right down a narrow passage. It dead-ended at a locked service access door. Salvo handed him the goggles.
Put these on.
Why?
Because I'm ordering you to.
Slipping them over his head and eyes, Kane was rendered almost completely blind. A thread of blurry light peeped through a seal at his cheek. Salvo adjusted the elastic strap, securing it tightly around his head. The darkness was total and impenetrable.
Can you see?
Think I'd tell you?
You'd better, for your own good.
No, I can't see a thing. Satisfied?
Kane felt Salvo's hand on his elbow, tugging him forward. Kane resisted.
Relax. If I wanted to chill you, I wouldn't go to all this trouble.
Kane allowed himself to be guided for a few steps, then positioned against a wall.
Don't move until I tell you.
Kane felt a sudden rising sensation in the pit of his stomach.
We're in an elevator.
Astute.
And we're going up.
Yes.
To where?
To where we get off.
The elevator rose, ascending far above level B and even A level. Salvo urged him away from the wall. The floor suddenly felt slick and smooth beneath Kane's boots. By the echo, Kane guessed they were walking across a big, high-ceilinged room.
From this point on, no talking.
Kane only nodded, feeling tension climb up his spine. With a hand on his elbow, Salvo guided him forward. They were now on a thickly carpeted floor. He detected the acrid odor of spicy incense, of unfamiliar resins. Salvo gently tugged him to a stop. The scent of incense was stronger, almost overpowering. Kane reached for the goggles.
Not yet.
The aromatic air shivered with the steady beat of the gong. Kane felt the vibrations against his face, like waves breaking on the shore.
Take them off now.
Carefully, Kane lifted the goggles away and off his head. His eyes were narrowed, prepared to be blinded by light. Instead, he saw only a gray gloom, and his eyes quickly adjusted. He stood upon a thick Persian carpet. Figures shifted around him, and although he could see only shadows, he knew they were men. A blade of white light speared down from somewhere above and impaled him. The suddenness of its unmerciful brightness seared his optic nerves.
Shit!
His hands came up to protect his eyes. The whirling spectrum of light dimmed, diffused, like pale sunlight barely penetrating a great underwater depth.
You are Kane, a servant of order, a soldier of the Vill, a warrior of the Baron.
Kane's vision slowly cleared, and he saw a dim shape standing before him. The shape looked strange, hazy, and he realized he was seeing it through a semi-translucent curtain, like a veil of gauze dusted with iridescent gold particles.
Answer me. Are you Kane?
I am.
Do you know who I am?
You're the Baron.
Do you know why I have had you brought here?
Kane breathed unsteadily. He couldn't seem to focus on the Baron's figure. He moved, swaying gracefully, almost as though he were performing some bizarrely beautiful dance. There was only a fragment of an impression of pale golden skin, slim arms, a domed head, and lean cheeks. Although he couldn't see the eyes, he knew the Baron was looking at him, waiting for an answer. He bowed his head.
No.
Because you belong to me. From the day of your birth, you have belonged to me, as did your father and grandfather.
Cain didn't dare look around, but now that he remembered that other people were present, a bit of his fear ebbed.
Who am I to Baron Cobalt?
I offer you the chance to be one of my chosen ones.
Why? Chosen for what?
To hear the truth, to serve the truth, to protect the truth. And in doing so, protect all of humanity and what we have managed to build here from the ravaged ruins of the Deathlands.
Cain didn't understand. He waited for the Baron to explain.
Do you wish to hear the truth?
Yes.
Be warned then, Cain. Once you hear it, you must swear to serve it and protect it with your life. If you do not, then you die. Do you still wish to hear the truth?
Yes, Lord Baron. I wish to hear the truth.
Cain just stood there, cringing inwardly, knowing he was the focal point of critical stares from the shadows behind him. He could scarcely believe what he was seeing, and he was afraid to speak.
They are here among us. They have always been here, apart and remote, yet guiding us whenever the opportunity arose. Now their numbers have increased in preparation for the final step in the development of our species. Though mistaken for gods in many religions, they are not gods, but our superiors in every way, spiritually, intellectually, technologically. Records of their presence can be found in the texts of vanished civilizations, in ancient Egypt, Babylon, Mesopotamia, Greece, and Sumer. The knowledge of their presence, their goals, their many accomplishments, was preserved by certain secret societies throughout humankind's history. We are the latest in a long line of societies entrusted with the knowledge of their intentions and objectives. Therefore, we call ourselves the Trust. We call them the Archons, and since they do not object to such an appellation, we continue to use that term. It is appropriate in many ways. In ancient texts, Archons were identified with the Supreme Being and angels and the Law of Abraham. We do not know their origins, and in pre-dark days there was considerable debate whether the Archons were extraterrestrial, interdimensional, or pan-terrestrial. Don't look so startled, Cain. Yes, a few pre-dark peoples knew of the Archons. Secret covenants were struck with them by many governments and military bodies. Many pre-darkers saw their advance guard in the skies, flashing through the ether in their traditional disc-shaped vessels. They were called many things, chariots of the gods, flying saucers, or unidentified flying objects. A minority of our ancestors knew they were the vehicles of the Archons and knew them as friends. They have constantly aided us in our process of spiritual and scientific development. However, when humankind achieved the means to destroy itself, the Archons offered not only a way of preventing the destruction, but also a path to establish an era of enlightenment upon the earth. As was their custom, their directive, the Archons contacted a chosen few, endeavoring to pass on their knowledge to save us from ourselves. This is part and parcel of the Archon Directorate. After a period of turmoil, to assist a civilization to recover, then withdraw to see what humanity would do with its newly acquired knowledge. The last great period of turmoil before the nuke cost was World War II. The Directorate's primary thrust was to protect the planet from the new threat of nuclear annihilation. Working through their government and scientific intermediaries, the Archons provided the basic data and technology for the undertaking known as the Totality Concept. Ah, I see by your reaction, Cain, that the term strikes a responsive chord, but only a faint chord, thanks to the efforts of the Unity Through Action program to limit knowledge of the project. Simply put, the Totality Concept and the development of its many interconnected and related researches was the most ambitious and secret scientific project in recorded history. The Archons provided the crucial technology to translate and meld quantum and hyperdimensional physics with relativistic physics. The aim of the Archon Directorate and their involvement in the Totality Concept was to make nuclear war obsolete. Indeed, aspects of the many subdivisions, Project Cerberus, Operation Kronos, to name only two, should have rendered the threat of atomic warheads as impotent as stone knives and clubs. In a sense, the totality concept was a stunning success. The Archon Directorate had given humanity the step up it needed to transcend all its petty squabbles and political differences. Unfortunately, in another sense, its failure to bring such promise to fruition was just as stunning. Our benefactors, the entities who had nurtured us since we first discovered fire, had continually underestimated our instinctive need to wage war on our brother. None of the achievements of the totality concept, none of the hopes of the Archons themselves, were of any use whatsoever on that black day in January 2001. Although they had every right to do so after that, the Archons did not abandon humanity. The Directorate remained intact. They observed and watched as our planet became a wasteland, then helped as we tried to struggle back to our feet and rebuild. The Archons opened communications with the most powerful Baronese and convinced them to unite and impose a new world order on the rampant chaos. With their help, their counsel, those nine barons ensured the old Predoc days would not return. The Archons provided them with the location of government stockpiles of the redoubts that once housed the many subdivisions of the totality concept. They taught them how to operate and maintain the technology found within. They put the barons in touch with the few surviving military and scientific installations that had weathered the nuking and the Skydark. In short, if not for the Archon Directorate, there would have never been a program of unification. They forgave us, you see, assuming some of the responsibility for the failure of the totality concept. They had been unable to save us from ourselves. Therefore, they judged it best that succeeding generations never knew of their presence or the role they played in the development of the totality concept. One of the aims of the program of unification was to hide that knowledge, or make sure that the few who possessed it would translate the traces of the Archons and the totality concept into terms relevant to their own limited experience. The goals the Directorate had set for us were delayed by over a century, until humanity had regained some of its strength and creativity. At long last, the time is almost ripe for those goals to be achieved. But as with all ripening things, the process may not be hurried without risk of damage. The Archons have offered humankind another chance to evolve from our irresponsible animal ways, and that is a chance we must not, cannot ignore. So, Kane, despite your impressive record, there is only one service you can offer to us, to the Trust, one duty you owe humanity. You must join us, so we may fulfill the Archon Directorate's hopes and dreams, and finally rise above the radioactive wasteland we ourselves created. Kane, as your father before you, you are now offered the opportunity to serve a greater cause. We must have your decision now.
My father?
Kane fought down the urge to pinch himself, to reassure himself that this was all real. His legs trembled. It was as if he'd been living inside a giant soap bubble that was smooth and simple and symmetrical, and suddenly the bubble burst. Everything was different. He struggled to grasp the vast implications of the Baron's words. His reeling mind formed a mental image of Earth as a tiny speck whirling through an inconceivably vast universe.
The Archons. What are they? Are they human?
The Archons are a race unto themselves. That is all you need to know. You have heard the truth. What is your decision?
Where is my father?
He is still performing the work of the Trust. It is his wish that you be inducted into the society to which he has devoted his life.
I recommended you. I as well have been charged with a great responsibility, and your help will be immeasurable in discharging it.
I don't quite... Are we talking about aliens? What do they look like?
No one here has ever seen an Archon, except myself and my fellow barons, but their existence is not illusory.
If the work of the Trust is so important to our future, why is it conducted in secret?
That question is as sophomoric as the answer is obvious. Our people do not have the ability to properly evaluate such a revelation. Their reactions would range from disbelief to fear and then to anger and bloodshed.
You possess an admirable facility for seeking out answers, Kane. A facility shared by your father. However, there is a time for curiosity and a time for decisions. If you choose correctly, all your questions will be answered in time.
I choose to accept this honor, my Lord Baron. It is the duty of my family, and I vow to continue to faithfully discharge that duty.
Well said, Kane. And well chosen. Salvo is your guide and sponsor. Heed him and help him. He will administer the pledge of eternal fealty.
The golden light flickered, dimmed. Shadows suffused the arch, and Baron Cobalt stepped back inside them.
Turn, Kane.
Kane did as Salvo commanded, finding himself facing men standing in a semicircle around him. This was no fussy little men's lodge. Represented here were the top administrators of the Vill, plus the pinnacle-level inner staff members. Though he didn't know them all by name, he recognized a couple, including the doddering old man Salvo had addressed as Lakesh on B-level. He quickly took stock of his surroundings. The room was as large as a courtyard, lit by clusters of tall, scented candles in each of the four corners, but the ceiling was so high that no light reached there. Salvo stepped forward, placed his right hand on Kane's breast, over his heart, and after a moment, Kane followed suit.
You are about to take the oath of the trust. You are expected to obey its conditions, and that means you must make difficult choices. All former loyalties are superseded, swept aside by the oath. Do you understand?
I understand.
Repeat after me. Resolve is our armor, will is our weapon. Faith is our mission. Personal ambition is our scourge.
Resolve is our armor. Will is our weapon. Faith is our mission. Personal ambition is our scourge.
We solemnly vow that we will face death rather than disclose the secrets we learn here.
We solemnly vow that we will face death rather than disclose
the
secrets we learn here.
We sanctify ourselves in the service of humanity.
We sanctify ourselves in the
we
service of humanity.
We accept our responsibilities in the world as ministers of the Archon Directorate.
We accept our responsibilities in the world as ministers
we
of the Archon Directorate.
We promise to discharge our duties as befit servants of the future and to hold our knowledge sacred and inviolate.
We promise to discharge our duties as befit servants of the future and to hold our knowledge
sacred. Each member of the Trust administered the pledge, and Kane parroted it back to every one of them. It took a dismally long time. When the ceremonial give and take was over, Kane had memorized every word, every nuance of the vow. He was tired and thirsty, and it wasn't until the last man stepped away from him that Kane realized what an emotional ordeal he had undergone. He felt wrung out, enervated, and numb. And that, whispered a mocking voice in his head, was the entire point. The Trust shifted away, a few of them smiling at him. Abrams gave him a direct, iron-grim stare, nodded brusquely, and stalked out of the room. Salvo draped an arm over his shoulders.
I guess you're feeling pretty limp by now.
Salvo guided Kane out of the vast room.
Go home. Get some rest, Kane. Business as usual during your shift, for appearance sake.
Does that business as usual include doing something about Quanah Teague?
As they approached a set of tall, ornately carved double doors, Salvo stopped abruptly. He turned to face Kane, who also paused.
Is Teague still important to you?
No, not now.
Good. What about the Baptiste woman?
That depends. Did her arrest have anything to do with the computer disk I found in Wreath's slag hole?
Unfortunately, yes. The Dulce operation is our mission. Due to you, she found out too much.
Is she a preservationist?
She is. We have the proof. She used you, Kane.
And Wreath, what connection did he have to the Dulce mission?
Contract labor. We of the Trust must occasionally use men, and men make mistakes. Wreath made a very big one, a fatal one. He had no idea how crucial the operation is. So he got cute. He got greedy.
And he learned too much, and he got dead.
Exactly. Just like Bridget Baptiste.
And Grant? He was with me in the slag hole. Did he learn too much?
Not unless you got very careless.
I didn't.
Good. Then Grant is safe. though it's probably best to expedite his administrative transfer and then get him out of the field.
I agree. He knows me too well.
True. Remember what I said about old loyalties. Now, let's get you home so you can rest and come to terms with the new burdens you have accepted to carry.
It's a heavy load, but I look forward to the challenge, sir.
Bridget had been escorted to sea level, down a series of twisting corridors, and then into a large, featureless room. Several metal doors lined the walls on both sides. There, she had been stripped of her bodysuit and underclothes and searched. The cell into which they had pushed her measured hardly 6 paces one way by 5 the other. There was not a stick of furniture in it to relieve the monotony of the smooth white rockcrete. A dim, wire-encased overhead light cast a pallid illumination. As soon as the door shut behind her, Bridget's submissive attitude vanished. She darted first to one wall and then to the other, laying her hands against the cool walls. By touch, she located the miniature spy-eye lens hidden in a mortared seam, complete with a microscopic sound pickup. She sat cross-legged on the floor, and the rockcrete beneath slowly warmed from her body heat. She regulated her breathing and closed her eyes as if she were producing eidetic images. Though it required a great deal of mental effort, she refused to think about Kane. She lost herself in the recesses of her mind, studying, examining, and weighing everything she had learned in the Dulcifer file.